Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good evening, Radio Land, and welcome to Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby up atop the mountain at Simon Fraser University. We're also on the internet at cgsf.ca. We stream and podcast all your favorite shows, and you can find us on TELUS HD channel 7014. It is such an amazing show today. You'll be hearing from my first guest, who's currently in the miniseries Book of Negroes. He's won an Oscar, he's won an Emmy, he's been known on Broadway. Louis Gossett Jr. is with us. You'll hear from him in a little while. You'll also hear from nonfiction titan John Valiant on his debut novel, The Jaguar's Children, as well as Francis McKee from The Vaseline's talks about their new album, V from Vaseline's. That's where we're going to start the show today. This is their song, High Tide, Low Tide.
High tide, low tide.
you know my first guest from his role as Fiddler in the 1977 miniseries Roots, for which he won a Emmy Award, or you might know him from his Academy Award-winning role for Best Supporting Actor in the 1982 film An Officer and a Gentleman, in which he played Gunnery Sergeant Emil Foley. You may also know him from the stage in such roles as A Raisin in the Sun and The Blacks. He's in a new series. It's a CBC adaptation of Lawrence Hill's book, The Book of Negroes, and he plays the role of Daddy Moses. I had the privilege of speaking with Louis Gossett Jr. over the phone on Wednesday. Well, it's a real privilege to be joined on the phone today by Oscar and Emmy-winning actor Louis Gossett Jr. Louis, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure. And you're in Vancouver, one of my favorite places in the world.
Well, thank you. It's certainly a lovely town to live in.
Right.
I wanted to have you on because you're in the new the Book of Negroes miniseries, which was one of my favorite books that I read a couple years back.
Right.
Why did you want to be involved in a project like Book of Negroes?
Well, first, it's a highly historical thing. I started in Roots, and I did the audiobook of 12 Years a Slave. And up in Canada, I did the James Mink story, which is very similar. And it's not and this one is a comprehensive story. It's just got slavery in the background. It's got atrocities in the background. But it's really a triumphant story of a woman's life. And it was a no-brainer to ask to be included. So it was they were looking for me, and I was looking for them. And then was the wonderful relationship with BET.
And you know, we mentioned Roots off the top there, and of course that was sort of where you first became known to a wide audience. Do you see a lot of similarities between Roots and Book of Negroes? Would you say that Book of Negroes is sort of the Roots for a new generation in a sense?
It really is the Roots for a new generation. It's comprehensive because it's a real personal. That was Kunta Kinte. This is Aminata. And it's a true story. There's so many stories like that. But before we go to the next level to talk about other experiences about us as a people, this is the comprehensive six-hour story of this triumphant woman who made all of the journeys. She was sometimes a slave, sometimes she was not. But all the things that happened to her, having babies and losing them and getting married, the whole thing, it's completely dramatic. So it's more than Roots. It's more than 12 Years a Slave. This is a human woman who happens to be black, coming out of Sierra Leone and going through this experience. So it transverses slavery and Roots, and it tells the story at the same time. So this is the comprehensive story. Now, that makes it totally entertaining and totally riveting. You follow her all the way through in 6 hours.
You know, with this series and with a movie like 12 Years a Slave, it seems as if Hollywood or the people that make movies are ready to tackle these issues again. Why do you think that is? Can you pinpoint a certain something that perhaps made Hollywood ready to dive down this area again?
One word, the internet. Things that would happen in the history that we conveniently kind of put out of the way, things that we didn't know, we now know in the internet. Nobody can do anything without people knowing it, and it comes proper time for a tapestry of all kinds of people to be sensitive to one another. We have a bigger issue, and the bigger issue is the salvation of the planet and other things about cleaning the air up and taking care of our children. So this is the comprehensive story in Hollywood. The most sensitive people around in our society are sensitive enough to know that this is a story that people want to see. Plus, of course, it makes money.
Yeah, and you know, this book was such a big phenomenon here in Canada when it first came out. And Lawrence Hill, the writer of the book, I understand, also helped or was heavily involved in the production of the miniseries.
Yes, quite a brilliant man.
What was it like for you as an actor to have
him being the writer of the book actually involved in the adaptation of it?
Well, it's a through line, then. It's much more of a through line from him to the producers, for him staying involved with the writing of it and keeping the decency and the clarity of what he wrote in the book to see it translated on the stage, and he had his hands on all the way through. That's a wonderful thing.
Now, you play the character of
Daddy Moses.
Daddy Moses, yes. How would for our listeners who may not be familiar with or as familiar with the book or the series, how would you describe that character?
In Roots ways, that's the fiddler of the series, but he's responsible for leading these people to the promised land in Nova Scotia. He started this first church. The church is thriving today in Nova Scotia, but he is the man who led those people there.
Now, you've done Roots, you've done Negroes, you've done 12 Years of Slaves, and you've done a lot of other films, but is there a certain type of role or a certain type of story that you find particularly appealing to your senses?
Well, I like the challenge, that's number one. And the challenge, like an enemy mine, or Daddy Moses playing somebody who has to keep the fact that he's partially blind out of the people's minds, or the one having to work out so hard at over 40 years old to play an officer and gentleman and an enemy mine, but it's 6 hours of makeup. I like the challenge because it forces you into the character. The other thing is if it's rewarding to the audience. So that could be comedy, it could be drama, it could be action, but as long as it's a stretch and a continuum of my career. So I don't like to be typed as much, but I just like to do something that's challenging.
Blindness is always one of the hardest abilities or disabilities for an actor to portray. How do you get into that mindset?
Well, this character was it's a tough one. My favorite person who played blind, a couple of them, but Al Pacino in The Scent of a Woman was outstanding when he did it. I learned a little bit about what he did, but if you're blind for that long, and I chose for him to be blind almost since birth, he can see. But he had a fever, so he was able to see certain things. And he could see about 5 feet out of one eye. So in order to keep people from knowing that, except the people he wants to know it, he acts as if he can see, because he has adjusted himself. There's an adjustment happens with the human beings when they have defects of character. Stevie Wonder can see better than anybody I know. Some of the people who have lost their limbs or can't speak, they overcompensate for some wonderful reason, and they become quite eloquent. And this guy, Daddy Moses, is able to maneuver pretty good with his limited vision.
In many ways, is it almost a blessing for Daddy Moses to be partially blind, because then he cannot see the atrocities of what is happening to his people, or is it a hindrance?
Well, it does. Well, when you look at the last scene, when he finds out what's going on, there is a feeling. His feelings become deeper. So there's an overcompensation with his inability to see. He sees better that way because he can feel. His hands are much more expressive. And his feelings are much more in his fingertips, and that's why he says this wonderful relationship with Aminata. It's quite a touching relationship.
You've won many accolades over your life. You won the Emmy for Roots. You won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Officer and a Gentleman. But do you ever think how different your life would have been if you had accepted that basketball scholarship?
Well, I got the basketball scholarship. I was invited to the New York Knicks rookie camp, but I was already starting rehearsal with A Raisin in the Sun. And so my bubble burst when I went up there and I saw all these hungry young men fighting tooth and nail to get this job and paying much less money than I was already making. So it was a no-brainer. So I wouldn't have accepted it. I went all up until that particular time. I wanted to be a basketball player, but I didn't use enough time to be a professional, responsible, professional athlete. But God put something else in my face, and I had more money in my pocket than the average basketball player had in the bank. it's a different ballgame today, so I might have made a different decision. But then it was a no-brainer to do Raisin in the Sun and continue that my serious gift that I got as an actor.
And I know that you only took an acting class because of a sports injury. Do you remember?
It wasn't even an acting class. It was a sports injury that I started to do a little extra stuff for my English teacher, Gus Bloom. And he saw something in my monologues that I was doing in class. So he said, they're looking for somebody. They can't find somebody to play this lead in this Broadway show. Why don't you tell your mother to take you down there? You can't lose anything. Just go. And that's how I got into show business.
Do you remember that first audition that you had?
It wasn't. Yeah, I remember it very, very clearly because I came up on the stage and there was one single light on the stage, and I could not see anybody in the theater. And they started to giggle at me, and my feelings were hurt. And I walked out, and then going down the street, a man stopped me. And he said, "We weren't laughing at you. We were laughing because you looked so much like I did when I was your age." And that was the author of the play, Lou Peterson. And then he pulled me back, and to make a long story short, I did get that part, and I opened at the age of 17 on Broadway in a lead, in a play I had never seen a play, in a lead after the end of that summer in 1953, in a lead and Take a Giant Step, it was called.
Wow. I read an article recently, I think it was in the New York Times, where a writer wrote that the reason why a lot of African-American actors are starting to get recognized, and this isn't always true, but particularly in roles like 12 Years a Slave and Ray, is that they're getting recognized for roles that couldn't possibly be played by a non-black actor. What are your feelings about a saying like that?
Well, it's a very ironic thing that's happening. It's not only African-American actors. 12 Years a Slave, that was Chiwetel Okafor, and he's Chiwetel. He's English, and he was able to play this character. Quite a brilliant actor, Chiwetel. And then, of course, in Selma, David and the wife who played his wife, they're both from England. And Steve McQueen directed 12 Years a Slave, and he's from Britain. So, and then you've got Idris Elba, who comes out of England. So I think they studied hard. They studied at the Royal Academy or something, but their quality in the theater probably makes them kind of exceptional. Here in America, we have some outstanding actors and actresses, but now is the time. The time has come to tell all the stories about our people here in this country. Everybody must know everything about one another. So it's the next natural step. My dream is the next natural step to go continue on with this African-American legacy, And maybe the Harlem Renaissance, that are cowboys and wars, and so that we know everything about everyone else, and there's more sensitivity rather than friction. We need to know because we have a bigger picture to take care of. We have to take care of this planet and its weather, and its fresh air and its fresh water, and be a lesson and example for our children. And that's everybody. We're going into a global society. And we need to be sensitive that if something's hurting on one side of the planet, it's hurting on this side of the planet. It's like a wave. I have a foundation called the E-Racism Foundation to try and teach children those values.
Now, you were the, believe if I'm correct, you were the first African-American actor to win Best Supporting Actor. And the
first African-American man.
And the second.
Any Oscar.
Yeah. And the second African-American man to win an Oscar overall. What?
First African-American man, because Sidney Poitier is Bahamian.
Yes, right. What does that mean to you as an actor?
It means something very special. It's a piece of history. It carries with it an inhuman responsibility from time to time, because then you have to behave a certain way. You can't be human. And I grapple with that almost daily. Until here recently, I've made a piece to be just me, who I am, good and bad, and there's a freedom in that decision.
They talk a little bit about the Oscar curse, you know, because when you win the Oscar, you can't go any higher. Was that something that you had struggled with, or you found
well,
affected you in any way?
Curse. Yeah, well, I struggled with the Oscar curse because after I got the Oscar, there was no work. It took a minute for people to try it. And thank God for television, because I worked a lot on television. But it happens, but it's not happening here recently. I see Robert Downey Jr., he has gotten an Oscar, but I see all these Oscar winners they get enough money to last for a year, and they can come relax, and they do the projects that they like, the Tommy Lee Joneses and Kevin Costners and the George Clooney's. They're my heroes. They're the ones I respect. Sean Penn, Angelina, Brad Pitt, all of those guys are really very decent human beings, and they're doing relevant projects, and I highly respect them, and I'd like to be part of that crowd.
Speaking of television, are you going to pop up in season 2 of Extant?
Yes, I'll be in about episode 3 or 4. They're revamping it. Some people are gone, some people are coming back, and some new people are being included. So I know I'm part of the family, and one of the people I mentor is the wonderful Halle Berry, whom I love to work with. And so she'll make sure that Daddy's going to be there.
Television is one area that's just changed so rapidly over the last few years, and we're seeing some of the best work on television, and all these award-winning actors like yourself and Halle Berry are doing television. What do you like about television, and what can it afford an actor that maybe films can't?
Well, it's constant work. It's weekly. It's a bigger challenge, but television is growing up in its content. It's got its finger on the pulse of the public, and sometimes it gets a little fickle. But in all, it's getting quite relevant on all the networks and all the cables. We're doing stuff that in the past would only happen in feature films. So now it's very attractive to some movie stars to possibly go and do a television series.
Book of Negroes seems to be a very timely series in a way, because we're seeing a lot of struggles, I guess, in certain parts of the States. You know, there was the Michael Brown case, and then there was Eric Garner. What needs to happen in order for that sort of mob mentality to change?
Well, we have to be careful. If we call a so-called minority, we have to be careful. What we take into our system and the system of mob mentality is old rules. I learned my lessons, some of them from Dr. King, a great deal from Nelson Mandela, who, if anybody had a reason to really be violent, it would have been him after 27 years of imprisonment. But he took the time to find out that there is a much bigger picture. And the bigger picture is a two-sided coin of responsibility. On our neighborhood, the black neighborhood, that has to be the most pleasant neighborhood for people to come. In order for that to happen, we need to mentor our children, give them the responsibilities, pay attention to them, because that's what they're asking for, and create these holistic members, ambassadors of holistic peace, so that that neighborhood is people can visit without fear. They can come to our restaurants, eat our food, listen to our music, imbibe them in our culture, bring their businesses, and invest. And then the police will back off a little bit, so that friction thing must be separated. The person who can do that is the ones people are afraid of. They're afraid of our growth. It is our responsibility to allay that fear so we can both get along for the bigger picture.
You mentioned people like, you know, Mandela, Dr. King, and all these world leaders, and I know you yourself actually played the president in Left Behind. And then, you know, a few years after that, Obama gets elected. As you know, as someone who, you know, is a prominent African American who grew up in the in that turbulent civil rights era, what was it like for you to witness that? Witness the election of Barack Obama.
Oh, it was an enormous catharsis. I was in the lawn, looking up at about a 45-degree angle when he put his hand on the Bible, corrected him, and he started again. And I saw Michelle looking at him and looking at the Bible and listening to the words. And when he finally took his hand off the Bible, I was with Cicely Tyson. We both collapsed, and it was like a movie of fast forward. You know, when a movie goes fast, all of the atrocities, all the stuff that was personal that happened to us, all the lynchings, all the stuff, it was like a movie coming out of my mind. And we were sobbing. We didn't know it. And we got up and started hugging people. It was a complete eruption of emotion. And today, I am so proud that man is in the White House. I'm so proud of what he does and how he thinks and how he raises his family. He is a man of history, and I support him 100%.
So finally, just to wrap things up here, getting back to Book of Negroes, for the people who watch this series, and I guess predominantly younger people of my generation who may not be as familiar with some of the history that's talked about, What do you want them ultimately to take away from that piece of work?
From the Book of Negroes?
Yeah.
Well, just more information and more information about our feelings and our history. And there's so much more to say. So I want them to come back after seeing Book of Negroes hungry for more.
Well, Book of Negroes is a great book, and it's a fantastic miniseries, and it airs on the CBC here in Canada. And Louis Gossett Jr. plays the role of Daddy Moses in the Book of Negroes. Louis Gossett Jr., thank you so much for coming on the show today. You've given us here at Community Radio a real boost.
All right. And tell everybody at Joe Forties I'll see them soon.
Alrighty. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, look yonder, tell me what's that you see? Marching to the fields of Concord. Looks like handsome Johnny with a musket in his hand, marching to the Concord War. Hey, marching to the Concord War. Hey, look yonder, tell me what's that you see? Marching to the fields of Gettysburg. Like handsome Johnny with a flintlock in his hand, marching to the Gettysburg War. Hey, marching to the Gettysburg War. And it's a long, hard road. It's a long, hard road. It's a long, hard road. Hey, do you fall? Will be. Hey, look yonder, tell me what you see. Marching to the fields of Dunkirk. Looks like handsome Johnny with a carbine in his hand, marching to the Dunkirk War. Hey, marching to the Dunkirk War. Hey, look yonder, tell me what you see. Marching to the fields of Korea. Looks like handsome Johnny with an M1 in his hand, marching to the Korean War. Hey, marching to the Korean War.
That was Handsome Johnny by Richie Havens and co-written by Louis Gossett Jr. In 2006, my next guests reunited almost a decade and a half after splitting up. Since then, they have released two full-length albums, the second of which, V for Vaseline's, was released late last year. On the weekend, I had the chance to speak with one half of the duo, Francis McKee, on their upcoming tour and their new album, V for Vaseline's. Francis McKee, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So the new album is V for Vaseline's. How did this project begin for you folks?
Well, Eugene and I were just trying to figure out if we had any songs that we'd want to record, so we decided to get together, as we usually do once a week, and see what emerged. And it was quite evident that we still had some songs to sing, so we just over quite a short period brought all these songs together, and then we were going to record later on that year. And anyway, as it happened, the studio that we wanted to use was only available earlier in that year, so we just ploughed on and did it. So it was all very quick, from the sort of origin to the completion, really.
Given that you two work fairly close together, how would you describe your music making process in terms of writing?
Well, with this, it's always different. But with this particular run of songs, Eugene had a lot of music, and he didn't have any ideas for words or to kind of make the song whole, if you like. So I'm always really inspired by what he comes up with, and I started the writing process in terms of lyrics, and then we just bounce ideas off each other in terms of the structure of the song, and then any other changes to melody that get needed or added, or vocal harmonies, etc. It just kind of builds up from just bouncing ideas off each other.
Now, the first single is One Lost Year. What can you tell us about that track?
Well, again, it was just we wanted something that was quite dynamic. We didn't want to make long songs. That was our only kind of criteria for this album. We'd made kind of some long songs in Six of the Next, and we just thought, you know what, let's get back to basics here. And I'd been listening to a lot of, the Stooges. Eugene had been listening to a lot of Ramones. And I was just really taken by, A, the melody of these songs, but B, the brevity of them as well. So that's what we were kind of aiming for with One Lost Year.
The impetus for releasing that song as a free download.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to go that route?
Well, do you know what? Between you and I, if it was up to just Eugene and I, we wouldn't do that, because as soon as you give things away for free, people don't value it. And I think, unfortunately, the way that the music industry is going is that things are just given away as a teaser, as a way of drawing people in. And you know what? I don't think it actually works. I think people just go, oh, there's something else free that I'll maybe listen to one day. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. And I feel like, I don't know how you feel, but the music industry has changed so much within the last, you know, half a decade or a decade, that it's even harder for musicians to make money than it once was.
You know what? I totally agree. And I think my prediction is that soon, you know, a lot of musicians just won't be able to do it, just won't be able to survive. I mean, most musicians that I know have other jobs, or, you know, moonlight in other bands or whatever. No one, unless you're Mariah Carey or something, no one else can make money from music. And I think it's a real shame. I think, I don't know, certainly it's not going to be the way that we know it, that's for sure.
Well, I read a quote here from Eugene that said, "I've never made any money apart from my Nirvana royalties." So,
yeah, that's true.
What does that say just about how hard it is to succeed in the music business?
Well, that's it. You know, people do think that it's all glamour and fun. And don't get me wrong, I wouldn't do it if I didn't enjoy it. But I couldn't sustain myself on a musician's fee, because it's just not possible. Just really, what my advice to anyone that wants to become a musician, you know, and make a career out of it, is have another career as well.
Given all that, and you know, your feelings about the music industry, why did you guys decide to reform after, you know, 15 plus years?
Well, that's a really good question, and it wasn't a big cunning plan on our part at all. It really happened kind of spontaneously. First of all, I had had a solo record, and Eugene had had a solo record out at the same time, and we did a few shows together, and it was really good fun. And then my brother-in-law, who works in Chemical Underground Records in Glasgow, was putting together a charity event, actually for my sister, and asked if Eugene and I would play again. So Eugene said, you know what, it'd be really nice to do some Vaseline songs with a full band, because, you know, we never really did that. We split up really before Dum Dum came out. We never toured Dum Dum or did anything. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we did it, and it was really good fun. We really enjoyed it. And at the same time, Sub Pop had their 20th anniversary, and they asked if we would go over to Seattle and play the show. And we just thought, well, okay, we got a couple of shows in New York. I'd never been to New York, never played there. And we've just been asked to do shows kind of ever since.
What was it like for you guys the first time you played a show in the US or outside of the UK?
It was unbelievable for me, because, you know, I didn't realize, and particularly in America, actually, but I didn't realize with such fondness that people have for the Vaselines. I had no idea. And you know, when I when I'm doing these shows, I always sell merch and get to know the audience a little bit. And it's really nice to have conversations with people. And music does mean so much to people. And I think it is amazing if you go and see a band and you're able to talk to the artist and convey what you feel about it.
Is there a sense of pride in being a band from the UK that's playing internationally to the biggest economy in the world?
I wouldn't say pride. I actually think it's very humbling, actually, to be able to come over and people come to the shows. And you know, Eugene and I's policy is give everyone a good time. You know, you want to come and see a show and go out feeling good. So that's what we try and do. And if people, you know, enjoy it, then you know our job is done.
Do you find that there's a difference between UK fans and North American fans?
Yes, I do. I find UK fans are quite conservative, whereas American fans really let you know what they're thinking.
And finally, would you say that you have a favorite track, either, you know, just to listen to or to play live off of V for Vaseline's?
Yeah, I think my favorite track on the album is Inky Lies.
And what particularly about that appeals to your senses?
Well, I think it's got a really uplifting kind of sing-along Chaz and Dave style to it. But I actually think the lyrics are quite resonant of what's been going on politically. And you wouldn't really know that from the song, but it's really all about how the press has really interfered with people's lives to a degree that it really is quite unbelievable.
Well, the album is V for Vaseline's, and Francis and Eugene and the band will be in Vancouver next week. Francis, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for phoning me.
Cheers.
Bye.
That was Francis McKee of the Vaseline's, and she joined me on the line from New Jersey. My next guest is a nonfiction literary titan. His two previous books, The Golden Spruce and The Tiger, were both award-winning and received great praise, with The Tiger even coming runner-up in Canada Reads. This time around, he tries a hand as fiction, and the result is The Jaguar's Children, a compelling tale of the history of Mexico, the Zapotecs, unscrupulous coyotes, and labor practices. It is all told through the eyes of Hector, a young man trying to immigrate to the States, but left for dead at the border by his coyotes. I had a chance to speak with John Thursday.
Hello. So this was a very ambitious project for you, and you're known for your nonfiction. This is your first novel. Why go to fiction? This is a story that could have potentially been told in a journalistic style. Why did you decide to go the fictional route?
Well, fiction, it's a really, you know, different animal, so to speak, and it operates by a different set of rules, and it honestly comes from a different place. And there is this kind of ethereal, muse-driven aspect to it. You know, I didn't sit down saying, okay, today I'm going to write a novel, or I've always wanted to write a novel about X. It was, you know, the voice came first. The voice saying what he said, which is, you know, the first lines of the book. You know, hello, I'm sorry to bother you, but I need some assistance, and that's how it started.
And, you know, there's the old adage for writers, you know, when they give advice to younger people, they say, write what you know. You kind of went in the opposite direction with that, talking, you know, a first-person narrative about a Mexican Zapotec from South Oaxaca. How much of a challenge was that for you, given that that's not your world at all, even though you did live in Oaxaca for a year?
Well, I think if I wrote what I knew, I would bore myself to death. And Jonathan Dee, a wonderful American writer, was interviewed by Miguel Sujuku, a Canadian Filipino writer, and was asking the same kind of a question, you know, advice for young writers and this sort of thing. And Jonathan Dee said, don't write what you know. Write what you want to know. And that sums up perfectly my whole motive. You know, the Golden Spruce was driven by what I, you know, I didn't know anything about. I did not know anything about industrial logging or the hideout, or certainly about the Golden Spruce or Grand Haven. You know, I was going, the whole point is the adventure, you know, and likewise, you know, the Tiger, you know, looks at Russia, a place I'd never been. And so it really, the whole excitement is to find your way into this new world and then recreate it so perfectly that even people who live in that world recognize it as their own. You know, that's the real sign, that the true proof that, in the pudding.
Mexico has so much history behind it, and there's so much that we don't know or that we don't hear about or is false information. Did you have to do into sort of the history and the lifestyle and the traditions of the Zapotec?
Well, what's amazing is Oaxaca, second poorest state in a poor country. It's very far south, 2,000 kilometers from the border. There are 16 indigenous languages spoken there, 100 dialects. People speak their native tongue all through the generations. They aren't necessarily dying languages. So these cultures are intact. And so you have, you know, Zapotec spirituality, which is, you know, animist. You know, the corn is a god, the jaguar is a god, the clouds are gods. Overlaid by 500 years of Christianity, overlaid by SpongeBob and Snow White and NAFTA and drug cartels. But it's all there. You know, it's intact. And so you walk around with your eyes open. You can see a lot of it happening right in front of you.
The original decision for you and your wife down to move down to Oahu, what spurred that?
My wife is a potter and anthropologist, and we were living in Vancouver. I'd been working on the Tiger full-time for 2 years. She really wasn't seeing a lot of me. We had two young kids. She was doing a lot of the child rearing, and she really felt like, I need something to feed my soul here. And she wanted to work with indigenous potters, traditional potters, and also modern artists in Oaxaca, because Oaxaca, in addition to being a, you know, a fascinating place ethnographically, is also basically the Florence of Mexico. It is the art center, you know, outside of Mexico City. It's this very, very dynamic, beautiful, colorful place, and artists from all over the world go there to study and be inspired, and she wanted to go too.
We alluded earlier to the animistic traditions of the Aboriginal peoples of Mexico and Oaxaca, and animism is one of the oldest religions in the world, and yet no one knows anything about it. What did you find out about that particular way of life and belief system while you were down there?
Well, I think people do know a lot about it, and so much of it is responding to the forces that are relevant and powerful in your world. And if you are a human being modestly armed, a jaguar is going to be a significant creature in your world. If you have domestic animals, maybe they will be killed by a jaguar. That's going to be an issue for you. If corn is how you make your living and what you're trying to develop to stay alive, you're going to be really concerned with cycles of weather, really concerned with the state of the soil, and you might develop rituals that will give you a sense of order and even if it's illusory, a sense of control and at least a framework for understanding the forces of nature that you depend on to keep you alive.
The book delves a little bit into, you know, labor, agriculture, agribusiness, and sort of the unscrupulous nature that can arise when you have a big sort of multi-corporation running things. How big of a problem is that industry down there, the labor industry and the working conditions?
It's a very difficult situation. Oaxaca is the birthplace of corn, for the entire world. That's where it was developed. It took about 7,000 years to do it. Right now, NAFTA rules have made it legal for U.S. to dump surplus corn into Mexico on the order of millions of tons, driving the price down, which, imagine how that is if you're an indigenous person already living very close to the bone and your crop is corn, and all of a sudden this genetically modified stuff comes down by the ton and depresses the price. So what are you going to do? And a lot of people have left and go to the States to work. That disrupts the family cycle. It disrupts village life because all the tasks of running the village are voluntary. And it also endangers the citizenry because now drug cartels control the border in such a way, the south side, so that if you want to get smuggled across, instead of just going through a coyote who will, you know, smuggle you across, you're working within the structure of a drug cartel, and they really don't care. So they might kidnap you, they might rob you and murder you. They just don't have the same investment. And then on the other side of the border are these enormous fences that stretch for hundreds of miles, forcing people to take more and more dangerous routes. So Oaxaqueños, one in three of whom go to the States at some point, are now making much more dangerous journeys than they were 15 years ago.
Corn has, in many ways, become a bit of a darling for the GMO industry, with companies like Monsanto, Cargill, you know, things like that come to mind. What is it about corn specifically that makes these GMO companies want to utilize that crop?
You know, I mean, I think in this sense, you know, the Central Americans, the Southern Mexicans, you know, were geniuses. You know, they developed this kind of perfect food and, or at least, you know, a perfect starch. And corn is so versatile. It's so efficient. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the energy that you can get from a single ear of corn, though it's, you know, it's very water intensive to grow. But its value is huge. I mean, you could say the Zapotec and the Mixtec and the Aztec were people of the corn, we are too. When you look at our diets, when you look at what feeds the meat we eat, when we look at, you know, where we get our sugars from, we're people of the corn too. And it's just, you know, the versatility of that crop. Corn is currently the most valuable crop in the world. And so, you know, needless to say, if you're running a giant business, you're going to want to work with the most valuable crops. And I think that's one reason, and I'm guessing there may be, you know, at the biotech level, there may be something about the DNA of corn that, you know, I don't know if it's easier to work with, but they've certainly figured out how to do it. And one of the scariest things they figured out how to do is to put a ribosome inhibitor protein in there, which will make the seed kill itself. So if you try to replant it, it will die. And imagine if you've lived for 7,000 years by replanting corn, what that means for you.
And I think there's, you know, along that business of corn and agriculture, I think two aspects come into play: the economic side of things, which we've talked about a little bit, but also the changing environment, climate change. And
yeah.
How did you get a sense of if that's an issue down in Oaxaca where all this happens?
Yeah, climate change is, there were unprecedented rains and landslides in 2010. And I went down there. We moved out of there in June of 2010. And when I went back in 2011, you know, it looked like 10% of the mountainsides had sloughed off. You know, there's these huge gaping scars. And this is forest. This was, you know, intact, solid land. It hadn't been logged off. But it still, you know, became so saturated with rain. And that was unprecedented. So it's, and obviously corn, the corn cycle, the rainy season, the dry season, the planting season, you know, all that is very tightly dialed in and orchestrated, you know, over the generations. And that is being disturbed now. Not, you know, who knows how far it's going to go. You know, these are early days, you know, for climate change in Mexico.
We've talked a bit about the Oaxacans immigrating north to the States, Texas, Arizona. And immigration reform is a big issue in the States, especially down south, the border states. The Republicans want tighter restrictions. Obama wants complete reform. In your opinion, as someone who's sort of researched this a little bit and witnessed this, what do you think needs to happen in order for more Mexicans who want to immigrate to either have a safe passage?
Well, I mean, I think even before that, we need to look at the forces that are driving immigration. And, you know, Mexico is so dysfunctional, it's so corrupt, it's so dangerous, it's so cynically run right now, that there needs to be this, you know, kind of a massive intervention at every level of government, army, police, local government. And, you know, if that were to happen, people would be much more likely to stay. You know, so that's one reason. Why are people leaving? And then, on the other hand, as far as allowing people in, there's no getting around the fact that our fates are linked. And basically, the entire southwestern United States was once Mexico. And when you look at it ethnically now, demographically, there are lots of Mexicans who are still there, who are moving in. There are counties that are 40% Mexican, dozens of them, all along the border. And our fates are linked. And you know, NAFTA, you could argue, is one way of acknowledging that fact, that we have a shared fate, shared economy. That's all true. And, you know, then the question is, how do you, you know, there are certain jobs Americans don't want to do, and how do we want to reward and acknowledge the people who are doing those things that we actually, you know, part of us doesn't really want to see them doing it or deal with them doing it. And there is, I think there's a kind of, it's really complicated. And for people, and I'm talking about it from Canada, from a great distance away, and, you know, I'm very cautious about oversimplifying. And there isn't any one solution, but there needs, I think, probably a more, you know, I would lean in Obama's more forgiving direction. But, you know, on the other hand, immigration right now is at an all-time low, historic low, partly because of the fence, partly because of the economy, partly because it is so dangerous on the southern side of the border to even try to get across.
There's been a lot of criticisms lately of the agreements like NATO and NAFTA. Mm-hmm. If something like NAFTA wasn't in place, and which would prevent these big multinationals like Monsanto to come in and dump their materials, would that make it safer and more viable for these workers, or would it make it worse?
I think that the drug industry is a separate animal from NAFTA. I have no doubt that they're intertwined in some ways. I mean, the drug culture and that economy is so pervasive and so intertwined with, you know, American appetites and the American economy. They're inextricably linked. But I think if NAFTA were outlawed, you would still have a really powerful drug industry. What you might not have is large foreign corporations able to go into Mexico and change policy in ways that suit them and are not necessarily in the best interests of local people or farmers or people who have been, you know, keeping that country alive for 7,000 years.
And finally, one of the themes of the book is the jaguar as a spirit animal, as an ancient god to the ancient Zapotecs. Have you discovered what your spirit animal is?
No, I haven't. I know that I find animals extremely compelling. I've never seen a jaguar. I'd love to see one someday, but I'll be fine if I don't see one. But they are, you know, certainly an important symbolic being for southern Mexicans. And, you know, for a guy like Hector, trapped inside a truck, facing death, he's going to take his power where he finds it. And he finds it in his family and in his memories. And some of those memories include jaguars.
Well, it's a brilliant first novel, and I really enjoyed reading it, and I encourage listeners to go and get it. John Valiant, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Once again, that was John Valiant. His debut novel, The Jaguar's Children, is available now. Well, that about does it for this week. My thanks to Louis Gossett Jr., my thanks to Francis McKee of the Vaselines, and my thanks to John Valiant. We're going to take you out with One Lost Year by the Vaselines. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
I don't need to care about tomorrow. If we are doomed, then I'll go boom with you. There was a time when all I had was sorrow, but I met you, so I'll go boom with you. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. 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 Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it.
1 year, 1 year of losing it.
When I die, it won't take me to heaven. Here's to hell, cause I'm heading below. I think I'm down, cause you would be mistaken. I'm alive and I want you to know. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. 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 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it.
1 year, 1 year of losing it.
Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it.
1 year, 1 year of losing it.
Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it.
1 year, 1 year of losing it.
Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it. Got 1 year, 1 year of losing it.